Welcome to the 20th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm David Chad.
And as the cricketing world's attention turns to the Champions League in India, I'm afraid there will be no Toshiba maximums here.
And it's interesting, isn't it, how now that the Champions League has become something of a, you know, an annual event, seems to have lost quite a lot of interest, apart from the fact of the joy of watching big money franchises get beaten by Somerset.
That is the only time I find myself following the live scorecard of it. I see, are the Kolkata Knight Riders in trouble? Great, I'll tune in and watch them get beaten up. But it's been very hard to sort of get into. I find myself, I like the Trinidad and Tobago side. I mean, a little bit sad to see them have
knocked out
at
the last minute.
Close defeats. Yeah.
So having been entirely disparaging about the 2020s going on in India.
So for anyone interested, that is the Champions League in 30 seconds on Reverse Rep Radio.
Done and dusted. Washing our hands of that. Moving on, but we're not going to do our usual thing and just ignore all forms of 2020. We're going to move on and look at some very interesting matches between England and the West Indies, which came about through something of a slightly sort of dirty situation.
Well, it was kind of miserable. This series had no point other than to fulfil a contract, yeah. You know, a television contract. But I mean, do you think
it's a cartoonist dream, that situation? It is the very worst of cricket at the moment as it could be, really.
Yeah, but I mean, was it pointless in the end?
I enjoyed it. I hugely enjoyed it. It was helped by the fact that I've recently acquired Sky. And so I was able to watch those games. And I rather liked the fact that England spent an unbeaten... No, they didn't spend an unbeaten international summer. They lost to Sri Lanka in one of the one days, didn't they? but I rather liked the fact that England's nearly unbeaten summer ended with defeat to the West Indies. Even though it was an England second-string team, there was something... I don't know, I thought something sort of keeping feet on the ground.
Well, I think, the selection of the two teams was probably one of the most interesting things about this series. I mean, England came in with a really young side. They were giving a lot of youngsters a chance. The West Indies came in with a very new side, but actually...
But not young.
The real sort of similar to that was this Gary Mathurin, who... The most stunning performance in the second one, picked up three wickets for nine off four overs, and he's 28. And it's interesting. I mean, does it say? You wonder whether it says something about the health of the kind of West Indies production line, or maybe you just say, you know, if you're good enough, you are the right age. Perhaps it has just taken years.
Well, it's odd. I mean, I don't know anything about his career before he hit the headlines
a couple
of weeks ago.
He's only got 11 first class caps behind him. I mean, it's not been a long career.
Well, maybe that's the way. Maybe that's the way cricket's moving towards the late beginners.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, England, I think there was something quite exciting about the fact that you could get rid of England's first string and still pick a very exciting-looking young side. I mean, as well as picking a very young side, they picked, well, not a young captain, but a novice captain. And, I mean, it was interesting, Graham Swanston. I felt perhaps he was trying too hard. It was almost like
He wanted to make an impression. Well, there was certainly in the second one day... you could tell he was a spinner's captain, really, couldn't you, from the fact that three spinners were played, bowled most of the overs. And Dernbach, I think, only ended up bowling
although
three.
Although he rather liked Ravi Bapara. Ravi Bapara got a good shift in, I think.
He did. I wonder what Graham Swann's like in the changing room as a captain, actually. I think he's probably quite a good character to have around. But the interesting thing was that... the difference between, say, Strauss and Swan, I'd imagine, as a captain, is that Swan, who's always depicted as a kind of joker, and I'm sure is a very astute cricketer, doesn't seem to have the ability to actually detach himself from the game. And when, at the end of the second one dayers, they needed someone to come in and bat without running out their teammates to use the lessons learned during the rest of that innings, he didn't quite get that and decided he'd kind of get in on the fun as far as one out was concerned.
I think, sadly, that will kind of be the motif of his captaincy, those run-outs. And it was unfortunate that he was at the crease at the time, particularly the run out of young Scott Borthwick.
Yep.
He appeared entirely
Scott
guilty.
Scott Borthwick, he looked quite good with the bat,
actually. He looked all right with the ball.
And he looked all right with the ball.
That, unfortunately, will be how it's remembered. I personally think Swan would have made a better choice than Stuart Broad as captain. I like the fact that Swan as a spinner, when he bowls, does look like a thinking cricketer. I know that's a horribly overused cliche, but, you know, the way he sets his fielder, the way he bowls, frankly. But and there's maybe that those extra years, given there's something a little bit more stable, perhaps, than him than Stuart Broad, who does still have this firebrand thing about him.
Looking forward to the to the future, I'm kind of in two minds as to whether we should pay attention to the fact that England were roundly thrashed in that second one day. I mean, it was a bit like the bad old times, England getting bowled out by spinners in limited overs cricket on a on a turning wicket. Do you think we should read too much into it?
Well, I mean, I think it's a useful reminder. England have to go to Sri Lanka next year. And it sounds strange to say it, but to defend our title, you know, to defend our
role as doesn't happen all that often.
Well, it's usually defending
the title of dismal losers.
Yeah, and so, but that challenge of can you play limited overs cricket against spinners on the turning track is going to haunt us again. I mean, it was interesting in terms of looking at what this series showed us about 2020 as a format. I mean, I think it really took us back to basics in some ways. I mean, the West Indies victory in the second T20 was so much based on just brilliant fielding. I mean, the run-outs were generated often by, as well as poor running, direct hits. There were a couple of great catches there. And it showed you, I mean, the West Indies did once have a reputation for that, of being the ultimate fielding side. And it's a long time, frankly, since we've seen that from them. But it was impressive from them.
It was very interesting as well how the West Indians were, how that game changed so quickly. Because after the first innings, when the Windies were absolutely skittled, you thought that there was no way, you know, all the momentum was with England, there was no way the West Indies could come back into it. But I think that's one of the great redeeming features of 2020, that it's a great leveller, and that no side is too good not to have an upset against them.
Well, you're wondering perhaps T20 could be so important for the West Indies, because it's going to take them a long time to come back as a test side. But it might be an issue that they could at least have some success in that format.
Meanwhile, in the test arena, Sri Lanka have been playing Australia in what I think has been a very engaging series.
I disagree.
Australia, all right. Let me finish my spiel at least. Australia coming out 1-0 winners, having won the first test. A lot of rain, which made it a little bit miserable.
Not that much rain.
Enough rain. But what I thought was really nice about this series was the fact that the bat didn't dominate, and we see the bat dominate too much at the moment. I quite enjoyed looking at this new look Australian side. I loved the fact that Nathan Lyon in the first test bowled third change and batted as 11. Now that is harking back to a time.
I kind of disagree with what you've just said on so many different levels that I'm not sure where to start. Let's start with. Let's start with the test series as a whole. I think this was a really, really poor test series. I think the standard of cricket from both sides was poor. I think you have two sides who are frankly struggling. I think they're struggling to get out a genuine quality test 11. I think an Australia team past would have looked at that Australia 11 and had real issues with it. Similarly, a Sri Lanka side of recent times.
But that doesn't necessarily make the test series
drifted. I think the second and third test in particular, you were left hoping for a result, really, when from a very early stage it became clear there wasn't likely to be one. And the first test, I mean, I like, it's funny, we complain about surfaces that are too dead, and then we're now complaining about a surface that's too lively. But unfortunately, that Sri Lanka being dismissed for 106 on that turning pitch did kill that as a contest, really.
Two things. Firstly, I think that having a kind of a scrap between two sides who are clear, I mean, I agree these two sides are pretty poor. But I think a scrap between them can be very engaging. Think back to the 2009 Ashes.
I was going to use that, and I think that's a fantastic example of when two weakened sides can have a great series. The only issue I would say here, that was a series where it was consistently compelling, consistently up for grabs. This series so often just, I think drift is the word, like it sort of, there didn't appear to be a result.
And then, of course,
the third test was characterised by an act of gross selfishness by Angelo Matthews.
But I think this is the moment that defines the fact that this series wasn't drifting, because here was a player who took the game by the scruff of the neck and said, we are not going to lose this game.
Right, well, that's the one thing he didn't do. The one thing he did not do is take this game by the scruff of the neck.
He said, we're not going to lose it.
No, I think what he said to himself is, he said, oh, I really fancy 100 here. Even if it takes me a very, very long time and I consequently lose my team the game in the process. I mean, we are going to disagree on this. We're already
They didn't lose the game as a start.
You're 1-0 down. This is the key in terms of context. You're 1-0 down. I think you have to gamble. Better try and draw the game and lose 2-0 than simply accept a 1-0 defeat, which I think Matthew's approach ultimately did. Sri Lanka were ahead. They had Matthews batting. They had him batting well. Had he gambled and been a bit more positive, yes, he might have got out and left Sri Lanka with a very minimal lead and no chance whatsoever of forcing a win. But had he been that bit bold and made quick runs, Australia could have been put under real pressure in this game. So give them a day and a half to bat this game out with a 150-run lead. It turns into a real contest. And I really feel he let the side down in his failure just to be a little bit bolder.
So when Matthews comes in, Sri Lanka are 331 for 5, they're 15 ahead, and he goes on to make 105 of 269 balls. If Sri Lanka, this is in the first innings, if Sri Lanka are going to win that match, they don't have time to bat again.
Yeah. Yeah? Accepted, yeah.
So they need to make runs.
Yeah.
They need to make big runs.
Yeah.
And the only way that they're going to make big runs, having been at the stage that he comes in five down, is if someone can actually structure an innings. Because there's no point five or six people going in and scoring 30s each. That's not going to be enough.
Had there been more time in the game, I would agree with you. Had there been more time in the game for a structured innings, I think that would have been fine. Given the context of the game, I just don't think there was time for Matthews to play the innings. Taken in isolation, which I don't think you can take an innings in, it was a determined, gutsy innings. Given the context, I think it was necessary to just be a bit braver. And I think actually it summed up, in my opinion, that sense of drift, that willingness to let that test peter out. Going back to Australia, perhaps, they have a rather bizarre winter ahead of them. They have a slightly pointless... Well, not. It's certainly not pointless. It'll be very interesting, but I can't believe it's only two tests long. They've got two tests in South Africa. I mean, how close are they to actually competing there?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? If you had thought about this test series 6 months ago... I mean, this Sri Lanka series has actually raised more questions than it's answered in terms of Australia. And we don't really, I mean, we were asking all these questions beforehand about whether we'd see a new dawn in Australian cricket, la-di-da-di-da. And we haven't really seen anything, really. We've seen that Mike Hussey can bat, which he
we can. Sort of knew. We've seen two sides that actually aren't really too clear on where exactly they're going.
But I have to say, I think that South Africa are... question. I mean, this seems, as an Englishman, this is the wrong thing to say, but perhaps the best team in the world at the moment.
I think it's very odd if you think back the fact that Australia actually won the last time they were in South Africa. But I can't really see...
Well, that won't happen. I'll put money on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think if South Africa play to anything like their ability, they will rout this Australian side.
And
I think the Australian bowling lineup in particular will be hideously exposed against South Africa. And I really think their only hope, and it's an odd thing to have to rest on, is Mitchell Johnson. I think Mitchell Johnson has looked just so out of sorts for a while now, but I think he's the one bowler capable on his day of perhaps troubling this South
African. I think the strength of the South African side is that they have got is that they're really good at batting and they're really good at bowling is the essence of what I was about to say. But what was interesting with the Indian side this summer is that their batting was always under pressure from their bowling, because England always made runs. But the thing about South Africa is that they hardly ever begin an innings, whether in the field or with the bat, when they're behind in some sense, and it allows them to build dominance within matches in a very compelling way.
You feel they have an opportunity to win really quite dramatically and actually perhaps start to really assert their claim as being, you know, number one contenders.
So, from the archives, and this week we are going back to February 1979 and to one of the closing matches in World Series cricket. This was the second series in World Series cricket, the second season. The first one happened a couple of years before and had ended with World Series cricket actually being banned by many cricket boards. Packer was legalised and came back to power, and for one season only, we have this wonderful I mean, that's something we talk quite a lot about, this idea of the sort of a fantasy team, and this is exactly what World Series cricket enabled on a regular basis. You basically could just get the best players money could buy, put them together in a side and tour them around
the world.
I
mean, it's interesting, there's this instinctive suspicion within the game of the Packer-type figures, you know, whether we're talking maybe more recently about sort of the Stanford, Lalit Modi, but actually what they do, what they attempt to do is actually something that cricket fans kind of have always dreamed of.
Yep.
You know, this uniting of great players. And there was something just very bold and brave about, you know, a lot of the aspirations of this.
What I think is particularly poignant in a sense about World Series cricket is that it operated at a time when South Africa were in the international wilderness. Yeah. South Africa were banned because of apartheid from international cricket from 1970 to 1991 for those 21 years. And in this World 11 side, in this game in February 1979 against the Australian World Series cricket stars, you have three South African players of just undisputed class. Barry Richards opening the batting, Mike Proctor, and then Garth LaRue, who was someone whose career was completely overshadowed by not being, I mean, a fantastic pace bowler, never played.
There's
I think,
a real sense, actually, of wasted talent kind of getting a chance. I mean, Richards in particular, I off the top of my head, I think he left with a test average in the 70s after only ever getting the chance to play about five tests for South Africa. And you really get the sense, you know, there are players who the cricketing world at large were just deprived of seeing. It's then, funny because I remember we've done a World 11 game before, much more recently, when we talked about that kind of ill-fated experiment when Graham Smith
led
that.
Back in 2006.
Yeah, and that was sort of such a... But somehow, on this occasion, there's something a bit more... There's got a greater unity, perhaps, about
Well, when you've got Zahir Abbas, Tony Gregg, Imran Khan, Alan Knott, Derek Underwood to add to those three South Africans, I would, you know, you would probably feel a little bit confident as you strode to the crease. And similarly, with the Australian side playing in this game, you've got Kepler Vessels opening the batting. This is actually before he's made his Test debut, either for Australia or for South Africa, of course. You've got Ian Chappell, who's at completely the other end of his career. He's 1 year away from retirement. And then you've got Rodney Marsh and Dennis Lilly, who are both very much at the peak of their career. So it's an amazing... what Packer did was to create an amazing sort of melting pot of cricketing talent and stick it all together. And the result was a fantastic game.
Mm. Well, I mean, we have a sort of quite a low-scoring contest, actually, at the Sydney Cricket Ground. I mean, the Australian side bat first, and no one really makes much of a score. A couple of players make starts. In the end, actually, Vessels is 27, Hooks is 33, are about as good as it really gets. And they make their way to 172. With, LaRue,
Garth
mentioned,
LaRue,
I mean, 5 for 57. It is just that sense of a player who you feel, given the opportunity, given the circumstances, could have achieved so much in the game.
I mean, it would be interesting. I haven't actually really got an idea of how this was a day-night game. I don't really have an idea of how the fact that it was a day-night game affected.
Well, it's interesting because we're talking about a game that happened in 79. We're now, the ICC are now talking about the return to day-night.
Yes,
you know, it's interesting the extent to which this was ahead of its time.
Trailblazing.
You know, and there is something exciting about, you've got bowling attack, opening LaRue and Imran Khan opening the attack. It's quite something. But so Australia reduced to 172. but actually, the World 11 fare no better in response. Barry Richards makes 28, and from then on, there's really a series of pretty poor scores. It's actually up to the tail to kind of salvage things. They're 86 for 8 at one stage, until LaRue makes 33, Underwood makes 32. And those bottom two, the 10 and 11, kind of scrape the World 11 up to parity.
Well, they nearly score half of the runs, actually, didn't they?
So at this stage, it's really been very much a bowler's contest. Lilly, I mean, you've got him. What a wonderful display of fast bowling here. LaRue's taken a 5 in the first. Lilly takes a 5 in the second. in the World 11's first innings. So it's very well set up. We've only got 4 runs separating the first sides after the first innings. And so Australia's second attempt, again, not a particularly high scoring innings. You have a 96 from Hooks that really forms the core of the effort. Leroux again leading the bowling attack, taking 4 for 44. Imran Khan getting in on the act with 3 for 60. But it's interesting, it's one of those sort of cliches about the game. How often it's the low scoring ones that make perhaps the sort of the nail bite.
It is, and actually,
contest.
Just to go back to our previous discussion about Angelo Matthews, Hook's 96, which came at a fairly slow rate, admittedly not as slow as Matthews' innings, but the way that he stood in the middle of that innings and held it together while the likes of Vessels and Ian Chappell, Rodney Marsh were falling all about him is impressive.
You wonder it's very interesting to sort of get inside the heads of some of these players. I mean, a lot of them had made a decision that would really jeopardise their careers.
Yep.
Would seriously jeopardise the way they were viewed by fans, perhaps. And so, I mean, perhaps there was an extra need to prove yourself, an extra need to achieve something.
And then there's the added dynamic for people like Garth Leroux, who goes on to become the man of the match, which is that this was his opportunity to play on the international stage.
Yeah, yeah, and really, it was an incredibly rare opportunity. He seized it or he lost it.
So the World 11 are set 2-2-4. To win, which is in a game where that would have been the highest score in the game so far.
It's an intriguing chase,
and they're batting last in a day-night game as well. Mm.
And I mean, especially as we talk about a bowling attack led by Lilly. Ultimately, it's really a story of one man. I mean, we mentioned him already. Barry Richards plays the decisive knock. He makes an unbeaten 100. Ultimately, players like Zahir Abbas are able to contribute as well. But it ends up being not comfortable, but relatively easy. They get home by 5 wickets. And really, for Richards, a player who, so many talk of him, obviously we were never in the position to actually watch him play live, but so many talk of him who saw him as something unique, someone special. This may be really a genuine crowning moment for him to actually, in Australia, make the 100 that sees off an Australian All-Stars side. I mean, in terms of looking at the legacy of this game, of these games, I suppose, long-term, I mean, we could spend hours talking about Packer. We've really gone through it very, very quickly. I mean, do you think it's interesting that actually the games like this don't tend to get very much attention? Do you think the cricket establishment's
sweeping? The thing is that the Packer controversy, kind of the politics of it, has completely overtaken any of the cricket that went on. And actually, in a sense, quite rightly, because some of the match very, very close in time within the World Series to this one was had to be stopped because of riots, I think, in the West Indies.
Wow.
And it wasn't always a pretty sight.
I mean, we've covered the context extremely quickly, but I mean, in hindsight, this series has just become about the context rather than ever about the accomplishments of the players.
But actually, it's very often that when you have the most kind of political is maybe the wrong word, but the most urgency from outside the game. So the fact that, as you've said, players could have had their careers ended by playing for this. Often those are catalysts for actually very, very interesting cricket, and I think that's what we see here.
And it's interesting, this idea of a World 11 that genuinely functioned as well. Because I think as an experiment now, it's fairly dead in the water. I mean, there are obvious time constraints on it, aside from anything else. But this appeared to be a side, I mean, I guess just underlined by their success more than anything else, that worked as a team. They worked as a serious
and they toured together, so it wasn't just a one-off as that ill-fated game a while ago was.
To the book review, and this week we are looking at What I Love About Cricket by Sandy Balfour. And I think, I mean, it's easy to say this, but I think this book genuinely has something quite unique about it. Sandy Balfour is, well, he seems to be many things. He's a journalist, he's a TV producer. He also, bizarrely, is involved in the running of a fair trade chocolate company. So a true man of all...
Many strings, I suppose.
Many, many strings. And he's written a book that combines a sort of an obsessive depiction of everything that he loves about the game, but also connects it to very much his own life story, and particularly this one particular aspect, his daughter's first boyfriend. And at first description, that sounds like a pretty pretty odd and perhaps sort of unsuccessful
well, I suppose
combination.
That's the thing that we are always
Austin, when you're put in front of someone who doesn't really know anything about cricket and just thinks it's men standing around in white clothes doing not very much, and
which
you can't really fault that. But I suppose the thing about, so his daughter's boyfriend is one such person. And what's really interesting is the way that over time he's, you know, there's no kind of glib explanation of what the game is. But what Balfour does is to show how cricket is so absolutely connected with every aspect of his life. He can't describe anything without referring to cricket. There's a great moment just when his daughter's been born and he goes outside to the car and there's someone about to smash the window of his car with a brick and he's carrying his hours old daughter in his arms. And he sort of mentally thinks up a stirring speech against this chap who's just about to smash his car, which, you know, part of the sentiment is, don't kill my daughter. But somehow he ends up relating it to cricket in some sense for quite a long time.
Well, it's interesting because using sport as an analogy for life is very standard. It's sort of standard journalistic writing. But what he sort of does, I think, is show how the nuances of cricket really lend itself to it so well. I mean, what I enjoy about it, several of the reviews for this book talk about it as cricket's fever pitch. And I mean, fever pitch, for those who don't know, a book by Nick Hornby written about football that was kind of seen as the definitive football book. And really, it was seen as an obsessive's guide to football. What exactly was it that got a fan hooked? And I mean, what I quite enjoy about this is the willingness to go down to details. Things like, you know, the setting out of boundary markers, why that's entertaining. Yeah. I mean, his description, I mean, for me, perhaps the most enjoyable bit is when he takes his daughter's boyfriend, who's this skateboarding prodigy, but, you know, very much not into the world of cricket, takes this boy to Lourdes and somehow kind of wins him over, like the magic of the place. And it's something that I guess us cricket aficionados kind of always sort of believe deep down, that if you go to Lourdes, if you go to the mecca of cricket, you know, any infidel will see kind of the sort of the beauty of the game.
The other great thing about the book is that even though it can be ridiculously nerdy at times, cricket nerdy at times, it's hugely readable. I demolished it in, you know, a day and a half on a bus journey, and then, you know,
I found exactly the same. You know, the pages sort of flew by, didn't they? And perhaps it was this format of sort of anecdotes from his life linked into sort of these anecdotes from cricket. I mean, I think what's interesting, if you are reading this, perhaps as someone like the teenage boy, you know, a real novice to cricket, I think you would get an awful lot out of it. I think what's perhaps different if you read this as a real cricket aficionado is you find yourself kind of chuckling and nodding. There's a rather wonderful passage about the sort of know-it-all groundsman at the club, and you found yourself very much kind of agreeing with that.
It's quite reassuring in a sense to know that someone feels quite as you feel about cricket.
And also perhaps the fact that, you know, you're quite right in saying that there's nothing glib about it. It's, there's a willingness to actually say, what exactly is it that I like about cricket? Yep. And he realises that it's many things. It's these particular individual anecdotes. And it kind of helps you to understand your own obsession, perhaps.
What he's particularly fantastic about, I think, is his ability. He is a very, very good writer, and his ability to conjure up situations. So he says explicitly that actually he finds listening to the cricket more satisfying than watching it on television, something that I certainly would agree with. And there's a great moment when he describes the catch Paul Collingwood takes in the
one day,
so he starts off by sort of saying that in a sense it was disappointing to have seen this catch happen. Simply because otherwise your imagination can run wild. And he goes on to describe the catch over about three pages in the most amazingly satisfying and rich way.
Well, this is the thing. He actually stands alone very successfully just as a cricket writer. I mean, a couple of moments. I mean, this Collingwood catch, also the moment where he describes a Peterson reverse sweep, is just quite brilliant cricket writing. I mean, this quote here where he says, and in the silence, I imagined Collingwood catching 1,000 impossible catches, each better than the one before. Kind of a lovely image of what, you know, a good imagination and a radio can do. And then perhaps a slightly more simple thing when he talks about how how if you wanted to simulate the experience of being Paul Collingwood and taking that catch, climb on a 5-foot high wall and then fall off, which, you know, very simple and to the point and very accurate. But I think it's, you know, we review a different book every episode. We've all read a huge number of cricket books, and it's genuinely very difficult to find a book that you say is quite unique. And I'd find this book, it doesn't fit into that category of like casual, oh, isn't village cricket cute kind of memoir. It stands as something quite different from that.
Particularly in the way that it so effortlessly combines description of sort of what you might think of as mundane everyday life with cricket.
And there's also, I mean, do you think it's an evangelical book? I mean, do you think there's an attempt here? Do you think the aim in writing the book was to win over the unconverted, or would that be...
It's sort of quite tricky for those of us who are already followers of the Church of Cricket to know when you're starting out whether you are Balfour, whether you are the skateboarding boyfriend of the daughter, but certainly I found it quite a sort of heartening and reassuring book.
And there's a very honest admission here, really, that your life is defined by your obsessions, really. And he's very honest, you know. Cricket has been at the core of his life for such a long time, and he's almost really just not ashamed to admit that.
And this week we're asking whether Yorkshire's future, despite their relegation, might still be bright.
Well, the chairman would certainly disagree. Colin Graves, I mean, it's quite extraordinary this. You'd sense there would be maybe some sort of solidarity, perhaps, but there was none.
At least some responsibility from the
chairman. Well, perhaps, I mean, he came out very promptly after the event. It's down to the players who've been on the park, nobody else. The performance has been a disgrace. They've been unacceptable. The players need to take a long, hard look at themselves as I'm concerned.
And then the flip side of that is watching Johnny Bairstow batting for England, hitting the Indians all over the park.
Very exciting stuff. It's sad because I remember the exact Guardian article at the start of the summer that really raved about Yorkshire.
This will be a new start, yeah, a new dawn.
Well, and there was something genuinely exciting about a real back-to-basics approach.
Yep.
We would have a young side made up of local players.
So just to recap, this was a policy that Yorkshire stated quite explicitly at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, and
which
I
was
think
that they were going to go back to their old ways essentially and concentrate on basically not having overseas players, not really having players from outside.
But
Yorkshire.
I think this policy, I mean, why? Firstly, I would suggest it would be sad if it was if this policy was abandoned. I think after just one disappointing year, I mean, this policy was grounded not just in idealism, but in very good common sense. I mean, the reality is the financial situations of many of the counties are dismal. You know, it makes a lot of sense.
But they're going to be more dismal if they're not winning matches, because people don't want to go and see a team that's losing. And all I wonder is that, I mean, I just wonder whether that's a bit of a rose-tinted spectacles view of the whole thing. And I wonder whether actually times have moved on. Cricket is more international. The world is smaller. Now that you can't expect to put out a completely homebred team against the, you know, whoever's the Somersets of this world who have their overseas players, the other.
I think I agree with you to the extent. I don't think you want to make this a fetish. I don't think you want to be obsessed with we must have 11 Yorkshiremen on the pitch at all times. However, if the
idea of a county,
the identity of a county is to mean anything, then an emphasis on local players should be there. I think, for example, you know, I don't like going into it on this podcast, but if we do look at football, I think one of the problems that a lot of football clubs have had in terms of their identity is there's a complete disconnect with the local. There's an entire disconnect. And what Yorkshire created, if you are a resident of Leeds, you know, you're a Yorkshire resident who goes to watch a Yorkshire side, you are naturally going to associate and identify with that. So I think I realise that there is an element of idealism to it, but I think it's a bold aspiration.
Ultimately, I think that it will simply depend on the strength of the players that Yorkshire bring through. Of course, there is always the problem that if the players that they bring through are too good, Johnny Bairstow's of this world, they'll actually never see them in the summer.
And I know we've discussed this before, but it's this bizarre paradox in county cricket. Your dream are the players who are great and reliable, but not special.
But not
the
good
special
enough to
ones
play for England.
Instantly will go. I mean, I think the other issue here is it idealistic to believe that a really, really well-run academy can produce a winning county, a county championship winning 11? I don't think it is. I mean, I think it's possible to create a side that, I mean, perhaps that one of the key issues that's, I think one of the key problems Yorkshire had was the Jacques Rudolph issue, a player who'd been very reliable.
This is the question that I'd like to bring up, because when you have what I think one of the biggest successes of the Colpack era has been that counties who have handled it properly have essentially, I mean, it's the old-fashioned thing and the thing you get in sort of lower league club cricket, which is where you get a professional in who, yes, are the people who take five wicket hauls and score hundreds, but they're also the people who provide an influence on the rest of the team, who in essence coach the rest of the team. And that's what Jacques Rudolph seemed to have.
Well, there's a very interesting...
There's a marked difference between when he was playing and when he wasn't playing, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, particularly this issue of Adam Lythe, who, when Rudolph was there, I mean, Rudolph was brought in, actually, again in 2011, kind of almost as an emergency signing. But when he was there in 2010, young Adam Lythe really looked like, you know, fantastic, averaging over 50. Without him, he slipped into averaging them in the mid-20s. Mm. So there is something in your argument, I think, that they act as an influence. So I think perhaps the abandoning of foreign players. I just think it would be sad to see this policy abandoned en masse. Yep. You know, I think it would be sad to write it off on the basis of 1 year. I mean, I think perhaps the other thing it shows, and this is no bad thing, that First Division County Championship cricket is extremely strong. Mm. You know, Yorkshire had a bad start, and they were very soon... their situation became irredeemable very quickly.
You could easily ask why... county cricket is strong, and that's because it attracts some of the best overseas players, perhaps. So I think in a sense it's a bit of I don't think we disagree with each other outright. I think it's a bit of a swings and roundabouts.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be nice to see teams try this.
Well, and I certainly agree that the time has come to. Sorry, that's completely the wrong metaphor. But that we need to give Yorkshire a bit more time, that we can't say that this experiment is dead in the water immediately, despite the strong words of their chairman.
The very strong words of their chairman. Well, thank you for listening to the 20th episode of First Threat Radio. I can't believe we've got this on. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks.